everybody, a special welcome if you're joining us for the first time, and early apologies because we moved the front row closer. So you people right here, we forgot the salad bar sneeze guard, so just be on the watch. It should be all right. Anyway, we're in week two of a series called Here Comes Heaven, just a three-week run that will lead us right up and through Christmas Eve. And to get us going with our conversation this morning, I need to tell you about an opportunity I had a few years back. A local high school asked me to come and speak at the at their kind of their religious gathering that sort of ended the school year and marked graduation. It's called a baccalaureate, and it's a cool thing. It's a time to reflect. It's a time to dream. It's a time to inspire. It's a time to look forward. It's a time to look back. And when I asked them, you know, what do you want me to talk about? I mean, it wasn't specifically, you know, for people of the Christian faith. So I wanted to kind of, you know, honor the different traditions that were there. And even though I'm a pastor, so they expected some Jesus, because we always sneak a little bit of that in. That's in the contract, you understand. But they said, you know, what we'd love you to talk about is how to live a great life. Because these students are on the edge of making choices that are going to set trajectories in their life. And I think at their core, they all want to live a great life. And so if you could just speak, I mean, you've worked with people for decades. You've worked with people that have done really well, people that have struggled, people that have made mistakes, people that have had successes, people that have had successes after mistakes. And so, you know, how do you live a great life? And again, it's a great question for them, and it's a great question for us. Because if we're honest, deep down, especially, you know, times of the year like this, we're kind of 1 year winds down and we look forward to 2020. We sort of look at where we are in life and where we hope to be and then where we want to be. How do you live a great life? And so I remember I wrote down the question at the top of my yellow legal pad because that's how I roll because I'm kind of old school that way. And I said, okay, well, just without thinking, when I think of a great life, you know, what is it that makes a great life? And the first three things that came to my mind, again, without a lot of thought, were things that may come to your mind. I thought about fame, fortune, and influence. Fame, fortune, and influence. Because if you have fame and fortune and influence, then, you know, you do. You live a great life. And then I thought, well, actually, no, you don't. In fact, fame, fortune, and influence don't guarantee a great life. I mean, the more influence you have, the more impact you can make. But just because you make an impact doesn't mean you make a good impact. And if you don't make a good impact, then you get to the end of your life and most people don't say that you're great. Fame, fortune, and influence don't guarantee a great life. I actually know this to be true because of an ongoing multi-decade-long study that I've made reading People magazine. Who's with me? Anybody? Yeah, because what's up, Taylor? Yeah, so the idea is like, you know, I like to read magazines about great people or people that the world thinks are great, people with time and with talent and with influence and with wealth and with fame. And it's like, but you read these magazines and you start to see like, you know, they're beautiful people in beautiful places, but often what gets reported are things that would not lead us to think of them as great people. So when you think about it, you know, history has affirmed that the path to greatness is counterintuitive. In other words, if we chase fame and fortune and influence and think that's going to lead us to a great life based on our own casual observation of the way the world works, that just isn't the case. And so the path to a great life is counterintuitive. And what I want to take us now and kind of depart from my baccalaureate notes is I want to talk to you about the fact that nowhere in history is this more evident than in the days that Jesus was born. The first Christmas takes place under the rule of a guy who literally called himself Herod the Great. How do you like that? If you want to know if you're great, you just put it at the end of your name and then everybody uses it and then you're great. That's apparently how that works. But he ruled in Israel from 37 BC to around 4 AD. And if you look at the picture, you're like, dude, he looks a lot like another guy with a beard that we remember this time of the year, right? Yeah, I'm just saying. That was just for fun, right? Yeah, but Herod was at the peak of his fame and his fortune, and his influence during the years around the time Jesus was born. Herod had come to rule in 37 BC as sort of a puppet king for the Roman Empire. And so in the first century, the Roman Empire stretched from England to India. And so you say, well, how in the world did they keep order in a territory that large before the invention of the internet? Because, of course, Al Gore hadn't been invented yet, so no internet. So that's how that goes. How do you do it? Well, Rome would appoint puppet kings. And they would be given control over certain areas. They would seize control with the help of Rome. They would maintain control. And as long as Rome got their taxes and as long as the people didn't rebel, you were basically left alone. And so you know a little bit maybe about that, but what you may not know is that Herod was a fierce and ruthless warrior leader. Matter of fact, there's an account during the studies for today's talk that I found written by a Jewish historian by the name of Josephus, and he records what happened the day that Herod seized control of Israel's capital. Here's what he writes. He said, Herod besieged Jerusalem in 37 BC with a huge army of 11 battalions of infantry, that's 8,000 soldiers, and 6,000 cavalry. When the troops poured in, a scene of wholesale massacre ensued. He goes on, he says, for the Jews of Herod's army were determined to leave none of their opponents alive. Masses were butchered in the alleys and crowded together in their houses. And Josephus goes on, I'll spare you the details, but Herod slaughtered thousands of people on his way to seize control in Israel. And he said that he took control of Israel by the will of God. But then he went on to erect statues of the Roman emperor, a man by the name of Caesar Augustus. And if you're familiar with the Christmas story, some of these names are already happening for you, right? Emperor Caesar Augustus. And he put these statues up all over the land of Israel. And the Jewish people that were trying to be true to the worship of the one true God and knew that they were not to worship anyone but God, they were offended by this and they hated Herod. They feared him, and they hated him. Well, most scholars would tell you that Herod, during the first century, was the richest man in the world. Some would argue he's the richest person ever. Herod controlled Israel. He controlled the religious, the governmental, and the economic systems of Israel. He basically determined a taxation rate for the people of Israel that enriched himself and impoverished everyone else, because along with the Roman taxes they had to pay, they had to give 50% of the fish that they caught to Herod in tax and 12.5% of all the grain harvested to Herod in tax. Moreover, Herod amassed wealth because of a fad that swept through the Roman Empire in the first century. There was some thinking that became popular that balsam sap from a particular tree, the camphora tree, and in case you're wondering, I found one on Google for you. But the sap from this tree could be distilled into a perfume that was said to drive the ladies crazy a mile away. And it became radically popular with Roman soldiers. And here's where this helped Herod out. Herod had a worldwide monopoly on the balsam sap from the camphora tree, and he made incredible income from it. Matter of fact, historians tell us Herod's income was 100 times that of the entire nation of Israel. Once during an economic downturn, he paid the nation's tax to Rome all by himself. He set up a lasting endowment in Athens so that the Olympic Games would be perpetuated. And at one point, Herod had something like 500,000 people on his payroll. Herod spent his life and spent a lot of his fortune building a physical kingdom for himself. In fact, the construction projects were designed to demonstrate to the world and to history his greatness. And in fact, if you come with me and my wife to Israel in 2020, we got a couple trips that are going, you'll actually get to see a few of the sites that still speak to what Herod accomplished in the first century. But in case you can't make it, I brought you some pictures. So don't even worry about it, right? So what I want to do for like 6 minutes is show you four incredibly memorable things that Herod built. And then I want to kind of pull this back together and talk about the Christmas story. But the first site I want to take you to is down by the Dead Sea. Herod built a fortress palace called Masada. It was a place where generations earlier, King David had lived in the desert for a while when he was running from another king by the name of Saul. But Herod decides, David hid in the desert. I'm going to build myself a palace in the desert, and no one should be able to live in the desert. But Herod decides that not only will he live in the desert, he will live in the desert in luxury. So this is an artist's rendering of what Masada would have looked like. You can see the Dead Sea in the distance. And of course, the Dead Sea, the lowest place on planet Earth, salt water. You can't drink it. Nothing can live in it. That's why they creatively called it the Dead Sea. Exactly. But Herod here builds a three-story palace on top of a 1,300-foot plateau. Engineers today are not sure how he did it. He didn't have cranes. He didn't have loaders. And yet he built an incredible palace. I walked up it in July with my wife in about 97 degree heat. I barely made it to the top. And Herod built a palace here with an Olympic size freshwater swimming pool. Which raises a great question. How does Herod get water for his palace? And what Herod did is inside of the mountains, he dug these cisterns. And when you visit, you can climb down in this massive cistern that would hold tons of water. They said there was enough water storage potential at Masada for 1,000 people to have drinking water for 10 years. And Herod filled these cisterns because when it would rain up in the mountains surrounding the Dead Sea, water will come rushing through these deep grooves in the rock called wadis. And Herod's engineers dammed up the wadis and routed them into these cisterns. And so Herod had water at his palace, again, enough to fill his swimming pool. As far as food is concerned, Herod's engineers found ways to preserve food that was absolutely stunning when you consider it was 2,000 years ago. In the 1950s, when they were excavating Masada, they found one of Herod's storage rooms, and they actually found a jar, and inside that jar were figs, 2,000-year-old figs. And they opened the jar, and they ate the figs. They were still edible because of the climate down at Masada and the way Herod had chosen to preserve them. And again, about an hour after they ate these ancient figs, they were on a desperate attempt to find Herod's bathroom. Just saying, right? But Herod literally redefined what was possible in an attempt to demonstrate his greatness. That's site one. Site two is equally impressive. Site two is called Caesarea, or Caesarea Maritima, Caesarea by the sea. It's a city that Herod built set along the Mediterranean coast of Israel. And Herod put it there as a way to control trade. And in a brilliant example of brown nosing, he names it after the Roman Emperor Caesar Augustus. For generations prior to the construction of this city, Israel had lacked a decent port, and it cost them. Because trade couldn't happen, because ships couldn't dock along Israel's coast. And so Herod recognized the potential, and he moved into an incredibly inhospitable area. He literally drains the swamps along this region of Israel's coast, and he constructs a world-class city, which featured the largest artificial harbor ever to be constructed in the ancient world, a harbor that protected ships during storms, a harbor that could hold 300 ships. Here's what Josephus tells us about the city. He says, although the location was generally unfavorable, Herod contended with the difficulty so well that the solidity of the construction could not be overcome by the sea, and its beauty seemed finished off without impediment. So Herod drains the swamps and he plays Sim City, for those of you fans of the old video game, right? He built temples and a theater and an arena that sat 12,000 people. Finally, Herod for himself, on a small peninsula that jutted out into the ocean, he built himself a palace, and once again, surrounded by the salt waters of the Mediterranean, Herod built himself an Olympic-sized swimming pool, because why wouldn't you? Water was a problem for the city, and so Herod constructed 6 miles of aqueducts. You can still visit them to this day. He routed fresh water so that the city had a flow of fresh water constantly rolling in. There's even a legendary story that when Caesarea was being built, Herod took a trip to Rome by sea. And as he returned and saw the city under construction, he looked at his friend and said, "It's not beautiful enough. Tell them to cover everything in white marble." And they did. And one of my favorite things to do when I visit is to find a chunk of white marble to bring back home, although it's a little tricky to get it through airport security, but I've done it a few times, so it's obviously possible, right? But Herod engineered the inconceivable in order to demonstrate his greatness. Well, Herod is best remembered by historians, not for Masada and not for Caesarea, but for what he did in Jerusalem. Because Herod, in an attempt to sort of win the allegiance of the Jewish people, Herod expands and beautifies the temple in Jerusalem, that temple that had stood on the site for generations, the temple to God. Here's an artist rendering of what it looked like in its prime, but he took the temple that was there and made it 5 times larger. The temple stood 15 stories high and was covered in 3 inches of solid gold. Josephus describes for us these gold grape clusters that were the size of people. The colonnade that surrounded it, those are 50-foot pillars, and there were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them. To build the temple, Herod hired 10,000 priests because he believed that if they were to do the holy work, then they needed to be priests, and these priests cut 2.3 million stones. Some of the stones are so large that it took 200 people to set in place, and they go 30 feet into the ground. One of the coolest things that you do when you visit Jerusalem is you can actually tour the tunnels that go down into the earth alongside of this wall, and you can see some of the foundational stones that Herod's builders used, and it's absolutely stunning. When the temple was complete, Josephus tells us 18,000 people were out of work. But probably most significantly, Herod built this temple out of his own resources, literally redefining what was possible in the ancient world as a way to demonstrate his greatness. I just one more site, just for fun, because this is where this kind of intersects with the Christmas story. Herod wanted to build a palace for himself near the spot where he won his first major military battle. And the location, once again, was inhospitable and required miraculous engineering. Herod built it, though, and he called it the Herodium, after himself, because he's so humble, right? I mean, he wanted it to be defensible, and so he wanted to build it on the top of a mountain, but the only problem is where his battle had been won, there wasn't a mountain. And so I can just imagine that Herod is standing there with his engineers, and he says, well, we need to build it right here, but it needs to be on a mountain. And they're saying, yeah, but there's no mountain. And Herod looks back at him, and he says, build a mountain, like you would do, right? 2,000 years ago, no earth movers, no excavators. And here's the crazy thing they did. And when you look at it from a distance, it looks like a volcano. Herod moved a mountain. And what's crazy is if you're standing on the Mount of Olives in Jerusalem, where Jesus would have had one of the final conversations with his disciples, and you look to the south, you can see the Herodium in the distance. It's weird looking, again, because it doesn't have a top. The mountain is like it's rounded off like a volcano. And it was on the Mount of Olives, I believe, facing south, that Jesus said to his disciples, if you have faith like a mustard seed, you can say to that mountain, move. Throw yourself into the sea. Nothing will be impossible for you. And we read that and think, wow, moving a mountain, that's crazy. And Herod would say, oh yeah, that was like Wednesday. That's what we did on Wednesday. Really not a big deal. Yeah, right, right. The Herodium had 200 steps that went down into the earth. He built a lower palace as well. You can look at this next picture. And it once again had a swimming pool, because that's what you do if you're Herod. It was 9 feet deep, had a gazebo in the middle. And by the way, this is probably the most interesting thing. On a sunny day, especially late in the day, the shadow of the Herodium falls on a little town called Bethlehem. They're only 3 miles apart. So if you think about it, by all appearances, Herod the Great lived a great life. His fame, his fortune, and his influence redefined what was possible. But there is more to the story, because, see, despite all of his fame and fortune and influence, Herod lived a paranoid life. During his reign, he was desperate to protect his kingship. At one point, he thought one of his wives was going to betray him, and he had her killed. 7 years before Jesus was born, he had two of his sons drowned in the palace pool because he believed that they were a threat to him. Anyone who was a threat to Herod was executed. Rest assured, when Jesus was born during the time of King Herod, things were tense in Israel. Herod's greatest fear, interestingly enough, came from an Old Testament prophecy hundreds of years earlier, because Herod wasn't a Jew. He was the king of the Jews, but he wasn't a Jew himself. He had come to the throne of Israel through marriage. He was what they call an Edomite by birth. He was a descendant of a man named Esau. His descendants came from a kingdom called Edom, to the south. And a prophecy in the Old Testament predicted that Israel would eventually be ruled by a Jew. Even more shockingly, the same prophecy spoke directly against Edom and Edomites and to Herod, an Edomite king. Here's how the prophecy fell down. It said, a star will come from among the people of Jacob. A king will rise up out of Israel, and he'll win the battle over Edom. And so as an Edomite, Herod had a reason to be paranoid. He was constantly watching for someone who would be born king of the Jews. And by the way, if you're familiar with the Christmas story or you've seen Charlie Brown, right? There, it was a joke. It was a bad joke, but it was a joke, right? All of the lights on your dashboard should be flashing. So with that background, let's jump in to the account of the birth of Jesus that Matthew gives us. Matthew was one of Jesus' disciples. Here's what Matthew tells us. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judah during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who has been born king of the Jews?" He said, "We saw his star in the east and have come to worship him." So the Magi were Babylonian astrologers. Babylon's 500 miles away. And they spent their time looking at the stars because they believed what the stars demonstrated would happen on the earth. And so they're looking at the stars and they knew that a particular section of the constellations that would refer to Israel. And one day a new star appears in that portion of the sky and they think, okay, well, a new king has been born in Israel. And you say, well, did they really believe that? Well, they walked 500 miles. So I would say, likely, they believed that, right? And so here's how Herod responds. When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed and all Jerusalem with him. Now, we know why Herod was disturbed, but why all of Jerusalem? Friends, Herod is not somebody you want having a bad day. Do you get that sense? And so the whole Christmas story is shrouded in this incredible tension. There's a madman on the throne. And when Herod is disturbed, everyone is disturbed. And this birth threatened Herod's whole system. Matthew continues. He said, when Herod realized that he'd been outwitted by the Magi, because they, of course, go see baby Jesus, and they've heard a little bit about Herod, and so they decide they're not going to go back and tell him where he is. They run back to Babylon. He was furious, and he gave orders to kill the boys in Bethlehem and its vicinity who were 2 years and under. And we read that and think that just seems so impossible. But remember, Herod did anything he could think of to protect his throne. And Bethlehem, by the way, in the first century was probably 200 to 300 people. And remember, Herod had killed his wife and had killed his kids. He would think of nothing of slaughtering 10 to 15 children to protect his kingship. And so historians call Herod great because of his building projects, but just, did he really live a great life? He had all the fame and the fortune and influence that anybody could ask for, but he chose to leverage his potential to build a kingdom for himself. I mean, he made an impact on the world. His fingerprints are all over Israel to this day, but I'm not sure I'd call his a great life. See, the way of Herod is the way that comes naturally to all of us in a broken world. And I think I would describe it this way. We fight to get, and then we fight to keep. We fight to get as much as we possibly can for ourselves, and then we fight to keep it. We fight to keep control and to keep whatever we've amassed for ourselves. And so that's what comes naturally to us, but I would argue that isn't really what makes a great life. And so standing in a church a few years back, baccalaureate, graduating 12th graders, I made my plea. I said, if you want to live a great life, you're going to have to do something revolutionary. You're going to have to flip the script that the world is going to tell you is the script you're supposed to live by. Instead of constantly approaching life asking other people, what can you do for me? You're going to have to flip it and say, what can I do for you? Because I think if you take a moment to think about it, you'll know this is true. Great lives are lived in service to others. You want to build a great life for yourself. You want to leave a legacy. You want to leave this planet better than you found it. Fighting to get and fighting to keep will not get you there. But when you make a decision to give yourself away, when you make a decision to serve other people with your life, then all of a sudden, ripples of influence leave your life and begin to positively impact everyone around you. And I said, pastors have actually been reminding people of this concept for thousands of years. Say, boy, that's really revolutionary. Where'd you come up with it? I didn't. Jesus did. One day, Jesus and his disciples are on a walk. And they've been with him for a while. And they start to realize that he's the one that God was going to send. He has the power of God in his hands. He teaches like no one else teaches. He can do things no one else can do. And they start to realize, like, we're the inner circle to the most powerful man, and he's more than a man. We're as close as you can get to the most powerful human being that the world has ever known. But even with those in those disciples, they start to think, yeah, but I'm kind of the closest to him. You know, like, we're going to rank a thing, right? Because, I mean, I'm, you know, kind of a big deal. And so they're walking back to their home base up north, the town of Capernaum, and they're having a conversation. And of course, that's always a bad idea with Jesus because he always knows what you're talking about and thinking about. But Jesus, when they get into town, he decides to have a little teachable moment. You might call it a come to Jesus moment. I'm just saying. There you go, right? Right, but they get in. Some of you know the story well. Look at this. It says, they came to Capernaum. And when he was in the house, he asked them, hey guys, what were you arguing about on the road? So they weren't even talking. Like, they were arguing. But they kept quiet because on the way, they had argued about who was the greatest. And I just think Jesus laughs and he's like, guys, I can clear this up for you. I'm the greatest. And then, I'm just kidding. He wouldn't say that. That's what made him so great. Okay, here we go. Sitting down, Jesus called the 12 and said, anyone who wants to be first must be the very last and the servant of all. Anyone who wants to be first, you want to be great. You want your life to make a difference. You want your influence to ripple through generations. Go to the back of the line. Live your life in the service of others. In other words, you want to live a great life, give your life away. And I truly believe that the path of a servant does lead to a great life. I mean, none of us are going to do it perfectly. That's perfection isn't the point. But that's the path to a great life. And a life of service really is, in our culture, it was in Jesus' day, and it is today, a revolutionary thing. It can change your marriage. I mean, if some of us, if we walked in the house after church and just said to our spouse, like, hey, how can I help today? You'd have to pick him up off the floor, right? Like, what? Ha! No, he was listening. You're good. All right, yeah. But no, it changes things. Think about what it could do to your relationship with your kids. Just say, hey, is there anything I can do for you today? Is there anything you need? Is there any way I can leverage my influence to help you? Is there anything you need? Think about this in the workplace. So often it's competitive, but you know, you approach your team and you say, listen, how can I serve you? How can I help? How can I make things better for you? Think about what this can do to the emotional temperature at an awkward holiday gathering. Not that any of us have those, right? But this week we're going to be entering space and it can be a little tense. And if before you enter, maybe you just sit in the car before you go in and you just pray, God, help me to serve. Whatever that looks like here, help me to approach this and try to give some of myself away. Let me bring some light into this gathering, which so often can feel so dark. How can I help? It's a revolutionary way to live. And by the way, just for fun, as we come in for a landing, we study Herod the Great today as a footnote in the story of Jesus. And one of the interesting things about visiting Israel is you're studying the ruins of Herod's kingdom, and you're standing there as a part of Jesus' kingdom. Herod built with stones. Jesus would say to his followers, listen, I'm going to build my kingdom, my palace, if you will, out of living stones, people. I'm going to build my movement out of people. My lasting legacy on planet Earth is people, because influencing people and showing them the way to live and showing them radical grace and forgiveness when they mess up and inspiring them to live selflessly, that's how you live a great life. Jesus came among us as light and darkness and invited us to follow his example. And friends, 2,000 years ago, halfway around the world, we are not gathered to sing songs to Herod. His palaces are in ruins. His kingdom is over. But the revolution launched by Jesus 2,000 years ago is going stronger than ever, because it's still changing lives and it's still impacting hearts. That's why following Jesus, doing the sorts of things Jesus would do, really is the path to living a great life. Would you stand and I'll close us in prayer. Heavenly Father, especially this time of the year, man. We just thank you. Thank you for the hope that came to earth when your son was born in a manger in a small town in Israel. We thank you for what he represents, the hope that came that day. We thank you for his life, for the invitation that you extend to all of us to be like him and to learn a new way of doing life. Thank you for the challenge to live selflessly, to think of the potential of our lives as how we can help others. Thank you for the grace when we fail. Thank you for believing in us when we don't believe in ourselves. But today, for this moment, we just want to say thank you for Christmas. Thank you for loving us enough to send your one and only son to rescue us and to show us a new path. So we love you. We bless you. We thank you. In the matchless name, above all names, the name of your son, Jesus, we pray. Everyone said, amen. Friends, we have a few people up front. If you need to pray with someone, we'd invite you to come just under the angel over here, and we'd love to spend some time just praying for you. Otherwise, grace and peace. We'll see you in a few days as we celebrate Christmas Eve.